Coming up on this week's book show, Frances Mays has spent 30 years splitting her time between her native United States and adopted home in Tuscany, and writing best-selling books, including the classic Under the Tuscan Sun. In her latest, See You in the Piazza, she and her husband hit the road to explore the country afresh from north to south, eating and drinking their way through. Frances Mays, on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Frances Mays has spent nearly 30 years splitting her time between her native United States and adopted home in Tuscany, and writing seven best-selling books, including the classic Under the Tuscan Sun about the region. In her latest, See You in the Piazza, she and her husband hit the road in their white Alfa Romeo to explore the country afresh from north to south, eating and drinking their way through. Mays seeks the very best local food, wine, culture, and history that Italy has to offer and discovers countless unexpected charms along the way. The book is absolutely beautiful. It is entitled See You in the Piazza, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Frances Mays to The Book Show.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you. It's wonderful to be in Manchester. It's such a beautiful town.
At what point did you and your husband decide, when you start out on something like this, do you think to yourself, okay, this could be, let's do this, and this could be a book? Or do you say, let's go on a trip and see what happens?
Usually books come to me out of one kind of spontaneous idea. And this came when we were traveling down way south in Puglia, and we were going to these little tiny towns, places I hadn't even read about in guidebooks. And we were kind of rediscovering the joy of travel off road, off schedule, not having reservations. And each of these little towns had its own treasure. So I had the brilliant idea while I was traveling that it would be fun to go all over Italy and discover these places that usually just are passed right by. In the course of the book, we did a few other things too. We went to some of the towns in Italy that everyone knows about, like Genova and Parma, but very few people actually go there. So it became a kind of mixture of those two, the tiny, tiny towns with the one beautiful church or the one great bread maker or some particular thing that pulled us to that town.
How much planning goes into in advance of knowing that there may be that baker in that town?
We usually just chose a region and planted ourselves in a particular place and then took kind of meandering trips out to just see what was there. We talked to people along the way, and then of course each town in Italy has something wonderful. They have a tourist office. So you go in these little offices, and they're very well-trained people who will tell you all the things there are to see in that particular area. So that was invaluable, because we really were, even the GPS couldn't follow us in some of these places. I mean, most of them are places that things are written about, but quite a few of them weren't. This is a particular favorite of mine. The cover of the book shows the piazza in the tiny Baroque town of Scicli, way south in Sicily. And I had never heard of that. And then when I got there, I thought, why have I never heard of this? It's so beautiful. It's just a book of discoveries.
It is see you in the piazza. Is that just a common phrase?
Yes, it's a very important phrase, see you in the piazza, because when you leave a dinner at night or when you walk out of a shop in the late afternoon, somebody will say, see you tomorrow in the piazza, see you in the piazza. And to me, it speaks to what the piazza means in Italian life, and that is that it's this living room of the town, and it's this center where you experience a wonderful sense of community, and it still very much is important in Italian life, even with the advent of electronics and people being glued to their phones and so forth. You still go to the piazza every day, and you have coffee, and you meet people, and somebody buys your coffee, and you buy somebody else's coffee, and then you get your fruits and vegetables, and somebody tells you what you should be doing with this Jerusalem artichoke, and they walk in the butcher shop, and everybody's gathered around this big cow that's hanging up by a hook and dripping blood on the ground, and then you get another recipe that you don't necessarily want, but it's just the beautiful part of Italian life to me. And I always say, I went to Italy for the art and the food and the wine and the beauty, but really stayed because of the people. And that, to me, is symbolized in the piazza. Every town has one. They are often named for Garibaldi. Every town has a Piazza Garibaldi. Because, you know, he unified Italy, or tried to. Italy never really got unified, but...
You were talking a moment ago about going on this trip and going to various places and talking to people. Is that ultimately how you found Tuscany?
No, I first went to Tuscany for the art. I had taken Renaissance art and architecture in college, and I couldn't wait to get there to see all the things I'd studied. A lot of the Renaissance art, of course, is in Tuscany, so that came to me all the way through art. Of course, when I got there, the first time I was ever in Italy was in Bologna, which is just north of Tuscany. My husband and I were sitting under those beautiful arcades in Bologna having coffee, and everybody else in town was in the piazza, and they were smoking and running around talking to each other and getting up and down, and I looked at my husband and I said, these people are having more fun than we are. So that was kind of the first inroad of my sense of that vivacity of Italian life that I responded to so deeply and began to feel at home in that kind of world.
Who's having fun now? That's a beautiful life you have there now.
Yes, I've been there longer than anywhere else I've ever lived. I grew up in Georgia, was there for 18 years till I went off to college, and have lived several places since, but for 30 years I've been going back and forth to Tuscany.
Was there a moment when it started to feel like home?
It's mysterious, and it happened to me, and then I found out that it happens frequently. When I got there and had been there renting a house in the country for a month, I felt so at home, and I thought that was just unique, that I had some kind of metabolic pulse that responded to the place. And I was thinking that's something you really need to pay attention to when you find your place. And then so many people have told me they had the same experience, that they just felt at home there. So it was very early on. I do feel at home there, but at the same time, I'm always the straniera, the foreigner, because you are locked into your native language, so, and your native being, that it's, you know, you don't become Italian. You're still American. And I like going back and forth. I like seeing this country from that point of view and vice versa. And sometimes it's enlightening. Sometimes it's funny. And like when Bill Clinton was having the scandal with Monica Lewinsky and he was just about to get thrown out, the Italians would say, what is wrong?
Well, we're all saying that now.
He says, he likes women. What's wrong?
that's an interesting point, though, about the cultural differences. That must be fascinating. That must be endlessly fascinating.
It is. That intense sense of community that I was talking about is definitely one of them. Also, that very deep sense of family and how that translates in bad economic times like now. They don't mind living together for years on end, huge extended families. And I always thought, oh, that's so creepy to have all those people in the house. But I've come to see how wonderful it is and how there's not this hierarchy in ages. When you go to someone's house for dinner, there's the 95-year-old grandmother, there's the baby. If you have to get old, which I'm learning that I have to do, you don't get shuffled off to the side at all. You're still in that piazza having your aperitivo with your friends in the afternoon. I mean, sometimes here I go to things and I look around and I think, where are all the people my age? What are they doing? Why aren't they out? And I don't know what happens, but it seems like, as far as I've observed in small town Italy, people stay really active in the community their whole lives.
Like so many of your books, there's beautiful descriptions of food, as you mentioned, and recipes. How did you come across those? How did you find those?
Oh, that was really fun part of traveling. I started meeting chefs all around and began to notice this phenomenon, which is most of these chefs I was meeting were very young, and they had grown up in Ostuni or Gaeta or wherever, and they had gone out as young chefs to study with someone, to work in restaurants in Rome and Milan and Paris and wherever. But in the Italian way, they had come home because they wanted to be near their families. So they bring back the creative techniques. They were learning all these new things in other places and bringing them back to their very strong traditions of their local cuisine. So there was something really exciting going on with food in Italy right now. So I got, I think about 17 of them to give me a recipe for the book that they thought exemplified their style of cooking. And so they sent me all these recipes and I started testing them and finding that I was really learning something. Because I've been cooking in Tuscany for all these years and I wrote a cookbook about Tuscan food, but I was learning some new techniques and it was very exciting. It was great fun.
It's a good way of learning a culture, isn't it? And learning about the history of a place.
Yes. I was saying earlier that Italy was not ever really united because, you know, you always look at history and it gives you the answer. There were the papal states for so many centuries, and you could not leave a papal state without a passport, and there were those who could make sure you didn't get one. There were all these little isolated mountain villages where dialects developed, and there were invasions and big farms that were practically like serfdoms. So people did not travel. They stayed put in their little place. And they developed their own cuisine, their own pasta, their own dialect, their own art. And that's what makes Italy, I think, the most diverse country in the world, particularly for its size. It's shocking to me. It's the size of Arizona. Traveling north to south, it was fabulous to see how the food differed all the way down the whole peninsula. Way north, it's very influenced, of course, by German, Swiss, Austrian. Over in the Friuli area, bordering Slovenia, there's more of an Eastern European influence. In the south, way south, Sicily, Sardinia, there's old Arab influences creep in. All over, there are distinct traditions, distinct dialects, and still very strong, particularly in Sardinia, where it's not really a dialect, it's a whole different language. Of course, people speak normal Italian, what I call BBC Italian, everywhere, too. But if you're really intimate with people, you realize they're speaking to each other in dialect.
Are you recognized when you're traveling?
certainly in my town, Cortona, because a lot of people come there because of my books. But no, when I'm somewhere else, no, not at all.
And I assume that's what you want.
Yes, it makes it easier when you're trying to write about a place. I never say, oh, I'm a writer, I'm writing about this place. I don't, because I don't want it skewed in any way. Mm-hmm. I just want to have a normal travel experience.
Do you think you ask more questions than the average traveler would?
Oh, God, yes. And my husband is just notorious for getting in conversations with people. But that's one reason we love to travel is, as I was saying, the people are, you can't really generalize, but you almost can in Italy, that people are generally really friendly and warm. So even if you just have a few words of Italian and they have a few words of the English, you can get into deep philosophical questions. And my husband gets in the front seat of the taxi because he wants to talk. He wants to practice his Italian. He wants to get to know the person from that area. It's always interesting once you, open yourself up to encountering people.
What was the, when you went initially, your relationship with the language, and how has that changed over the decades?
When we first went, we didn't know anything, and then we rented houses for a few years, you know, just kind of looking at phrase books. Then we took a 5-week intensive class in Siena. We walked out of that class thinking we spoke Italian. We were terribly wrong. Because then we started restoring the house, and the men who were working with us spoke dialect. We didn't understand at that time how pervasive dialect was, so we started learning all this dialect. So we were speaking kind of scholastic Italian plus dialect together. It's gradually kind of gotten sorted out, and my husband, I would say, is pretty fluent, and as happened in my French class in college, the professor said after I gave a recitation, Miss Mays speaks French with a southern accent. So I think I do with Italian too.
I would think learning Italian from the construction workers, you'd learn all kinds of cool things.
Oh, I did. I learned lots of swear words. And there was one in Under the Tuscan Sun that I shan't repeat, because most of the bad curses in Tuscany involve the Madonna. And, you know, you don't even understand them, the Madonna Serpente, Madonna this, Madonna that. And the local priest came knocking on my door, and he said, Miss Mays, you have committed a terrible error by quoting this curse word about the Madonna. I said, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't know it was that bad. And he forgave me, but I don't use those terms anymore. I
no.
was throwing them around quite a bit. But
in this book, which I think is wonderful, but you still have such a sense of wonder of the place, of just a wide-eyed wonder as to this country that you've lived in for a long time.
That's because it continues to surprise me, particularly for this book, because I was in regions I had never been in. And I've written a book since then that's coming out next year. I've been to even more regions since then. So just that kind of shocking variety everywhere keeps me in wonder. I was born a traveler. My father said our family's motto should be packing and unpacking. I was always ready to travel and wanted to from the time I was 6 years old and started reading these series of books called The Polish Twins, The Dutch Twins, The Finnish Twins. I can still see them in the library shelves because I was in Fitzgerald, Georgia, learning that there was another world out there that I didn't know anything about. So the joy of travel is that it is still such a sense of discovery for me.
Frances Mays is our guest. The new book is See You in the Piazza. I want to talk a little bit about your other writing and your novels. My goodness, I love Swan.
Oh, thank you.
At what point did you think, okay, I mean, did you always feel, okay, I have a novel, I have novels in me?
I started writing as a poet. I taught poetry in San Francisco for 25 years, and I majored in English, etc. Poetry was what I lived and breathed, but I grew up reading everything I could read in the Carnegie Library. I read my way around it. And I always wanted to write a novel. I thought I would be a novelist too. But man, was it hard writing a novel. Because when you write memoir or travel, you're writing about what's happening, but you're writing a novel, you gotta have some kind of plot, or, you know. It's just difficult. You have to really be inventive. So Women in Sunlight, my novel that came out last year, was a lot easier than Swan. Swan was kind of deep into my family psyche, things that happened in my family, so that's always difficult.
When you think about it now, do you think it is dual projects that, yes, I would like to continue to write about Italy, and yet I would also like to continue novel writing?
It's just that kind of a lightning strike occurs, and you think all of a sudden, that's my next book. It happens. It's not planned. In fact, I'm now finished with this other book I've written. I'm finished with this, finished with Women in Sunlight. And I'm in that kind of fallow period where you're thinking, what's next? What's next? And that's a very exciting place to be, because your mind starts casting around in lots of different directions. And I have a feeling I want my next book to be based in the south of this country, but I'm not sure yet.
When you look at living in two places and going back and forth, I mean, what's amazing to me about your story is you wonder, well, I'll just be honest. You and your husband, you're both professors. Why could you afford that house?
Oh, well.
That thing is immense.
It is. It was expensive even then, you know, for that time. But I had just gotten a divorce, and we had split what we had. And I took everything I had and bought that house. It was a terrific risk at the time. And everybody in my family told me, you will live to regret this. And now they come visit all the time, and I can't keep them away.
Yeah, not such a bad idea, was it?
But it was a great thing to do, because it was a big risk, and I hadn't particularly thought of myself as a risk taker. But that taking that risk made it easier to take a lot more. I don't know why, but I just put down my life savings and bought the house.
That's the first risk, and then you start to redo the house.
Yes.
And that's a project.
Yes. If I had had any idea what I was getting into, I wouldn't have done it. But.
And I assume that continues to be a work in progress.
You know, all old houses have it in for you. They want something. We just decided in November to add two bathrooms to the house. We can't add on to the house because it's not allowed, but in two rooms, we blocked off walls and made bathrooms. In the course of doing those bathrooms, the workers discovered three frescoes. And we've been there 30 years, and we discovered one when we first moved there in the dining room. We were scrubbing down the walls just to re-whitewash them, and this kind of scumbled blue started to emerge, and we kept scrubbing, and here's this beautiful scene of lake and mountains, and it's contemporary with the house, like 300 years old. In the upstairs rooms where we were adding these bathrooms, they're more like Liberty and Art Nouveau era stencil paintings on the wall. Stunning. We were stunned. Just the fact we knew this house, we didn't think it had any more secrets, but it has more to say.
The fresco downstairs, my memory serves me, was pretty much a depicting the view from the house.
Is yes.
That right? Yes.
It looks like what we can see from the front of the house.
How interested were you in the history of the house and finding out the history, and how easy was it to find out that history?
We haven't really found out that much about it. We know it's about 300 years old, and we've met a few people who lived there during World War II. One woman told me her father found a lead pipe in the garden in 1946 or 7. He brought it in the house, and it blew up and killed him. It was a German leftover piece of mine. So we know that five trees in a row were planted for five daughters who lived there, but we don't really know. They didn't keep records in these country houses back then.
No, but you remember the explosions.
Yeah.
So then Under the Tuscan Sun comes out, and so just bring me through this. The book is published, and the book is it does well, right? And then the movie comes out, and then that's when everything just goes nuts. Is that correct?
No, it had been a nuts bestseller before that. But
well,
then
it had been
movie,
a bestseller, but is that
yeah,
really what...
It got kind of a second wind from the movie, yeah. And still, it's still being picked up. It's been translated into 54 languages. So it's still getting picked up by Estonia and places, you know, that... Or 20 years later, bringing it out.
I assume, because this is usually what people tell me, but I assume that the most shocked person in the room to hear that is you, right?
Yes, because I had always written poetry, which sells like nothing, you know. When Under the Tuscan Sun came out, it had a very pretty hardback cover, and my editor, who was in San Francisco, called me and said, Frances, this book is really... selling. He expected it to sell like my books of poetry. He said, it's really selling. We think it's because of the cover.
Nice. And then you got a new agent, right? When that happens, then life just changes, right?
Well, I quit teaching. It was a great gift to me to be able to be a full-time writer. Because I was chair of my department at San Francisco State University, and it was the largest creative writing department in the country. We had 30 full-time faculty members. So I was working, scrambling, dealing with all these writers who have, you know, egos. And so I was stuffing my own writing kind of in the cracks, getting writing done during the summer, but it would take me kind of a month to recuperate. I did have the summers off, and I was grateful for that. But being able to let my job go, and I loved teaching for 23 years, 24 years, but it was fantastic to be able to be a full-time writer. It's a slash of luck.
Frances Mays' new book is See You in the Piazza. It is published by Crown. What a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe. It's
Thank
a pleasure
you very
to be
much.
Here.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.